So it's good to be back. I know you've been having some fantastic sermons and talks during the Hinterland Habit series. And we are resuming what we missed in. And today is a classic passage in the Bible, which is made for this series. And we're going to carry on into Leviticus. We're probably going to be ending Leviticus today, although it depends what life is like this week. But we're going to look at a particular passage which is going to be slightly challenging, certainly challenging to prepare for and to plan. But first of all, we're going to have a little bit of a quiz. I know we've had one already, but I want you to do, just on these tables, to go through these slides when you see them and try and identify where the place is and the whole of the slides, how they joined up, what's in common. What's going on with all those slides? So this is the first one. What is this place? Any ideas? You can shout it out. Edward, Egypt, yeah? Mark, what did you say? No? No, it's Luxor, Egypt. Anybody know this one? Any other takers? No, it's the Lotus Temple in India. Anybody? Anybody know what this is? That's Ellen Road. Yeah. Anyone know what this is? Mount Fuji. Yeah. Fuji. Anybody recognise this? No, it's Lourdes in France. Well, no, it's Indonesia. It's the Borobudur. The Borobudur. Mecca. Yes, what particularly? Fifth Avenue, yeah. Glastonbury Tour. Uluru. Uluru, please. Lindisfarne, Holy Island. Yeah. What's connecting all those things? Places of pilgrimage, places of worship, sacred space. Ellen Road, sacred space, yes. So a variety of things, whether it's man-made structures, whether it's sport, whether it's consumerism, whether it is temples and worship spaces, the preservation of sacred space in our world is vital. And Leviticus is about sacred space. It is about the protection of the holy tabernacle. And we've looked a little bit about this already in the last couple of weeks, well, a couple of months before I went away. The holy sanctuary having to be protected and purified because it's a place where God resides. So holy ground, holy space is designated, it's prepared, it's preserved for Yahweh. This is the basic stuff. So Yahweh is going to come and enter, it's set aside for his presence. So its purity, its holiness is protected from pollution or violation by the wrong people and the wrong objects. Think about a hospital during the pandemic. During the height of COVID, you think about the space that hospitals occupied in our world that were particularly needed to be protected from the virus. The ultra-low tolerance that hospitals and wards had for the virus. It was about who had access, when they had access, what they had access with, and how they had access. And of course, where they had access. So, in the same way, the tabernacle, the holy sacred place of the divine, the residing of the divine, had been protected. And Leviticus tells us that story of the priests who were purged, they were purified, they were prepared, they had to be fit to occupy that space. They had to be made holy and prepared with all the rules and the regulations. And they were hyper-regulations, and we're not going to go into those. They had to make sure objects they carried in there were clean. They had to make sure their bodily was clean. It was about bodily fluids. It's about all the purity structures and systems in place to make sure that when they went in there, they were clean before the Lord. And remember, cleanliness and purity is not automatically a moral category within Leviticus. It's more a ritual category. And so you have the people. You have Moses, who's like this super, super priest, who only met with God, that spoke with God, that listened to God. You had Aaron the high priest, and you had Aaron's sons. And I've enlisted Ian to do some more drawings of Aaron's sons today. And we see in Leviticus 7 the regulations and the restrictions and the instructions for the priests. And then we have Leviticus 8 and 9, which is an ordination service. It's a commissioning service for the priests, particularly Aaron and Aaron's sons. A little bit like this. There we go. Circa 1992, when when I had hair. Yes, I had hair a little bit time after that. Yes, yeah, so that was the day in July 1992 when we graduated from Moorlands. And just a few of us, you may recognise Ian on the right-hand side there, and a couple of really weird people on the left. And so that was our graduation. So what we see in Leviticus 8 and 9 is a graduation service. It's a commissioning. It's an ordination. And an ordination to enter into sacred space. And Josh is going to read a passage from Leviticus 8, verses 1 to 4. Oh, you're reading that. Yes, you are. Well done. Josh is not going to read that at all. Don't read it. It is such a fine line. Yeah, it's the beard.
Leviticus 8, the ordination of priests. God spoke to Moses. He said, take Aaron and with him his sons, the garments, the anointing oil, the bull for the absolution offering, the two rams and the basket of unraised bread. Gather the entire congregation at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Moses did just as God commanded him. And the congregation gathered at the entrance of the tent of meeting.
Thank you. So 7 days of preparation. The who, the how, the where, and the when is carefully orchestrated as the Lord commanded. Joss, now is your time.
Moses then said to Aaron and his sons, cook the meat at the entrance to the tent of meeting and eat it there with the bread from the basket of ordination offerings, as I was commanded. Aaron and his sons are to eat it. Then burn the rest of the meat and bread. Do not leave the entrance to the tent of meeting for 7 days, until the days of your ordination are completed, for your ordination will last 7 days. What has been done today was commanded by the Lord to make atonement for you. You must stay at the entrance to the tent of meeting day and night for 7 days, and do what the Lord requires, so that you will not die. For that is what I have been commanded. So Aaron and his sons did everything the Lord commanded through Moses.
Brilliant, yeah. So we see it's a big deal going on in the tent of meeting, in the tabernacle, in the sanctuary. There's a lot at stake. As the Lord commanded, so you won't die. Okay, so you really think that actually you're going to take this seriously. You know, if I don't do this, I've been told I'm going to die. Trained, equipped to do the ritual in sacred space. So we learn very quickly that God's presence is dangerous. They should get danger money for doing this. And it is one scholar that likened the tabernacle to a nuclear power plant. The whole idea that it's driven by this holiness of God, and extreme care and caution is taken in entering into the nuclear power plant of God's tabernacle. And you would think there are rigorous monitoring and checks in any nuclear power station. You may recall, of course, Chernobyl 1986, and if you've seen the TV series I If you weren't around at that time, you'd remember watching that series, just the catastrophe that happens when routine checks don't get done, when monitoring doesn't get done, when things go wrong, when people encroach on different areas of space and don't do what they should have done. And disaster comes. There's consequences. So there's a lot at stake. Emily, could you read 9 verses 22 to 24, please?
Then Aaron lifted his hands towards the people and blessed them. And having sacrificed the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the fellowship offering, he stepped down. Moses and Aaron then went into the tent of meeting. When they came out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all people. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat portions on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted for joy and fell face down.
Excellent. So this is just the way of context for the next passage we're going to read. So this is the eighth day, the right time, the right way, the right people, the right place, and the holy favour of God, the consuming fire of God, consumes the offering, and everybody goes, phew, that was close, but we got it right. Everything was good. The divine favour of fire blessed us, and they're humble, and they give thanks, and they worship. We come on to the story now of Nadab and Abihu. There's no pause in the action. Remember, there are no chapters, no verses in the Hebrew Bible. It's still the eighth day, and we get to chapter 10, and it says this. Now Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, each took his fire pan, put fire in it, placed incense upon it, and they offered alien fire before the Lord, such as he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord meant when he said, through those who are near me, I will show myself holy, and before all the people I will be glorified. And Aaron was silent. I bet he was. What is going on? Here we have Nadab and Abihu presenting alien fire. Celebration turns to tragedy in an instant. This is a continuation of the action. There's no context, there's no explanation. They are just consumed after offering what is alien fire. There are some other descriptions which would describe it as unholy fire, unfit fire. Unauthorized fire actually is a very common translation of this. So they are consumed, they are incinerated. This is the ultimate playing with fire. And that's what happens to them. Alien fire. So what is going on? So many questions. So many questions. And if you've been here for a while, you will know that we've talked a lot about the morally challenging passages we find in the Bible, but also those passages which challenge our portrait of God. A portrait of God which is hard to understand. And I'm sorry to disappoint, but I'm not going to go there today because I just go on about this quite a lot. And if you want to listen to those sermons, you can go on those online. If you want to talk to me afterwards, I'm happy to do that. But I'm not going to particularly go there today about the morals or the portrait of God that is painted here in this passage. I touched on it when the last sermon I went before we went to Australia a little bit. But what I'm going to do today is try and offer some possible explanations about what's going on and possibly offer some learning points from this really bizarre, strange, weird, terrible, tragic incident. So what did they do wrong other than not do what the Lord had commanded, which of course is a big deal, as it turned out to be? There were a lot of suggestions that they were under the influence of alcohol, because there's a conversation later on in the chapters about that. I want to offer a couple of possibilities, And then we're going to look at five things that we can try and learn from this. I think that they encroached too far into the sanctuary. They went into a part of the sanctuary which was reserved for the high priest Aaron. They went beyond the boundaries of where they were supposed to go. They trespassed where they were supposed to go. And in doing so, they usurped their role and their responsibility. They entered into sacred space, which was outside their job description. What did Moses say to Aaron? Through those who are near me, the Lord said. So it implies that there are only certain people that can gain access to that holy place. And Aaron, the high priest, was one of them. And later on in Leviticus 16, as you see that one in there, Leviticus 16, it says here, the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they drew near to the Lord and died. The Lord said to Moses, tell your brother Aaron he is not to come at any time into the sacred zone, inside the curtain, before the cover that is upon the ark, or he will die, for I appear in the cloud upon the cover. So they were not to come at a certain time. They were not to come just any time. They had to come once a year. And that was reserved for the Holy of Holies and the high priest. So the high priest Aaron went in there, but Nadab and Abihu, they usurped their father's responsibility, their father's authority. They thought they could do his job. Don't you hate it when people try to do that? You go away for 6 months. No. I'd just like to say that Bernie and Heather did a fantastic job. But I just, that was set up for that, Bernie. Sorry about that. So they were the wrong people in the wrong space at the wrong time. You can't come at any time. It's once a year. You can't just say, oh, I think I'm going to pop along to the Holy of Holies today, offer a few sacrifices. The nuclear power plant of God's tabernacle is not a drop-in center, according to Leviticus, according to this code. So, wrong time, wrong place, wrong people, and it looks like the wrong coals as well. The wrong type of snow. The wrong type of coals. And this is another little keep out, unauthorized sign. We'll come back to that later. So Leviticus 16 says, he shall take a censer of full coals of fire from the altar before the Lord and two handfuls of crushed sweet incense, and he shall bring it inside the curtain and put the incense on the fire before the Lord, and the cloud of the incense may shroud the cover that is upon the covenant, or he will die. There is no record of Abihu and Nadab taking the coals from the altar, from the designated space. So not only were they the wrong people at the wrong time in the wrong place, but they offered the coals which were unauthorized, making this strange fire. Nadab and Abihu went rogue. They went off piste. They went freelance. But in the priesthood and in the service of God's nuclear power plant, service of God there is not a choose-your-own-adventure. It's not do what you want. Innovation and spontaneity is clearly not welcome. You can't just do what you want. It's not freestyle. So they violated the where, they violated the who, the how, and the when, and in doing so, their offering was strange, alien, unfit, unholy, unauthorized. And such was the gravity of their offense. There is no verbal warning. There is no disciplinary action. There is no, you know, we'll give you a second chance. There's no suspension pending an investigation. They were fired. Sorry about that. I got Ian to do a little bit of a picture of an Alan Sugar. I think that's as good as you can get. So how do we even begin to learn from this bizarre passage? I want to say five things. The whole scene, chapters 8 to 10, moves us from theory to action, from regulation to practice, from ritual procedure to real life. And Chrissy has already touched on this morning, which was helpful. What was instructed, taught, commanded, couldn't be left in the realm of theory. A time had come when what they learned had to be put into practice. It had to be lived where and in a place of jeopardy. You see, this is not a lesson, and you wouldn't expect this from me, this is not a lesson in following God's rules and Bible commands and instructions, or else it will go badly for you. Now, there are other churches that will give you that message, and you're free to listen to that message, but this is not that message. That's too simplistic in my book, and it's too superficial. Of course, there is a ricochet of consequences for human behaviour, ours and other people's. Sometimes terrible, often tragic. I'm not denying that. But the Christian life is never theoretical, it's never procedural, and it's never prescriptive. It's not about following a whole set of instructions. We've reduced discipleship very often to a few top tips about how to have a good marriage, or how to be successful, or how to grow a church. The call of Jesus, as we know, on our lives isn't about knowing more and following the guidelines. The example of Jesus is a, what we've talked about before, a lived theology, not a theoretical one. You see, other-orientated love can only be practiced. Patience, that Danielle talked about so brilliantly last week, can only be practiced. Ask Bernie this week. You've been practicing patience, haven't you, Bernie? Has it been dead easy? No. Of course it hasn't. Because it isn't just about listening to Danielle's sermon about patience. It's about getting out there every day and try and live it. And this is the movement that we see on display in these chapters. See, the Christian life is not prescriptive, is not procedural, but neither is it a freestyle event. Grace is not a license to do what we want, but it is living wisely and lovingly in the grey, messy, ambiguous bit in the middle. Secondly, in offering unauthorized fire, alien fire, perhaps Nadab and Abihu believed in the legitimacy of their own holiness. I'll just put that picture up there. Perhaps they believed or presumed their coal, their fire, was the acceptable way to worship God. They constructed a better way of finding God's favour. Their version of coal and fire would be enough, surely. They offered new terms of service. You see, we all, myself included, are in the habit of offering unauthorized coals and alien fire to God. We have it in our minds. What do we bring as unauthorized coals that deep down we think will earn us God's favor or get God's attention? We do stuff, we are stuff that we think deep down in our head we deserve God's favour, attention, love because we do this. What alien coals and strange fire will make us legitimate, accepted, and enough? The coals of our busyness, the coals of our perfectionism, which again, Danielle talked about last week. The coal of our omnicompetence, our productivity, This is alien fire. This is the self-justifying narrative that goes on a lot in our heads when we rewrite the terms of our holiness and our salvation. Just like Nadab and Abihu. You see, the reality is the cross and the resurrection are the definitive, ultimate, authorized terms, procedure, ritual, offering that is enough. And that all we bring, basically, is unfit. The truth is that nothing needs to be done by us which hasn't already been done by Jesus on our behalf. And the religion of grace that Christianity is needs to be received and not constructed. We don't need to build a new narrative around how we are justified and welcomed and loved and accepted. Thirdly, sacred space is still being violated. We are familiar, because you're good theologians and scholars, with the broader biblical concept of the whole earth being God's tabernacle, God's temple. So the earth is sacred space, not just one place where God resides. And the earth, its order, its well-being, its purity, its holiness, is God's concern. And protecting and preserving the tabernacle of earth from violation is our Christian calling, as our human calling, says he that's just come back from Australia. I recognise the hypocrisy in that. But we recognise our responsibility, we know our responsibility, and we see it failed and futile when institutions, governments, churches, multinationals invade and penetrate and violate the sacred boundaries of earth. They usurp their responsibilities. And one of the tragic things about visiting Tasmania in particular was the recurrent theme of the historical violation of those first settlers on the Aboriginal First Nations people. Repeatedly, time and time again, in the sort of houses we visited, in the historical landmarks, there was a recognition that the first peoples of Australia, their land and their identity was violated by the settlers that came over there and thought they discovered Australia. But that is that history, that historical thing, still goes on in the work of the multinationals that we buy from, and we know that. Secondly, about sacred space, is that we know that all people are sacred space. All people, no matter how they identify, is sacred space. One of the things about Ian's drawings is he always tries to get Dylan in there. And Dylan's a hairdresser on this occasion. You see him there? I think on the last time he was in there. You see, our daily relationships and interaction with people are to be, I'm afraid, tested and filtered through the fundamental understanding that all people are sacred space. That all people are tabernacles of the divine presence. You try that this week when an Uber cyclist tries to run you over. You try it when your most detested, disliked politician comes on the news or happens to be at an investigation of some kind. A Jewish writing says this, that person and bodies are vessels that house sacred intelligence. Vessels that house sacred intelligence. Tabernacles of the divine. And that is tested in the crucible of our relationships, our interaction with people. Third little subsection of this is that we're very conscious in political and public discourse and government policy, of course, that the sacred space of body and personhood of refugees and asylum seekers is being profoundly violated at the moment. And then the last bit of this part. We can't also, sadly, ignore the violation of the sacred space of female bodies and personhood in the news. And it seems every day there are terrible stories of men who, like Nadab and Abihu, presume to encroach on the sacred space of women by their words and behaviour. They bring unauthorised fire and coals and usurp their responsibility and role. And tragically, many churches have failed to preserve the holy boundaries and failed to respect the personhood of these houses, these people of sacred intelligence. So, fourthly, whose failure was it? You see, Nadab and Abihu were newly ordained, they were trained, they were instructed, they were given skills, but they still went rogue. They still went freelance. Didn't they realise the danger? Didn't they realise the jeopardy and the risk? There was a lot at stake, after all. You'll die if you don't do what I've commanded. Is there a lesson here about leadership development, about mentoring, about discipleship, about accountability? You see, Aaron himself has got a very dubious track record about respecting leadership and about authority, having tried to do a coup to try and override his own brother's authority, Moses. So was he partly responsible for the failure here? Was Nadab and Abihu failed themselves? Was their unfit fire, actually unfit mentoring, unfit discipleship, unfit supervision, and unfit accountability? And so when we hear of the moral and ethical failures of leaders, whether it is in church or charities or organisational structures or government, we soon realise that actually individual and personal failure rarely happens in isolation. And I'm sure it didn't happen in isolation here, although it seems like in the text. And then it's right to challenge the institutional and structural parts of an organisation where there is failure that allowed those men and women to fail themselves. Finally, last one. We've got to recognise the raw power of fire as a reality and as a metaphor. You see, there are three types of fire in the story. The context was the fire of the divine favour consuming the sacrifice that everybody was humble when they saw that happen. They were pleased, there was a blessing. The fire of presumption and arrogance, the strange fire of Nadab and Abihu. And then the fire of destruction, the consuming fire. And the strange fire, the alien fire, the unfit and unauthorized fire of Nadab and Abihu, was essentially a religious act. It was a ritual of worship. So fire is sacred, and it is treated with caution. One of the things that we did in Australia in the Blue Mountains was go on a walking trail in the rainforest, and we were in the particular spot in the Blue Mountains when we met a group of tourists that were just queuing up to go up to the cable car to the top of the forest. And there was an Australian guide there, this chap that was really full of bravado. He came up to the sort of station bit and he started doing push-ups on a cable car beam. And I silently swore to myself. But anyway, that's not about the story. And we heard him talking to this group of tourists, and he said the reason why Australia was getting hotter, and because of all these incredible destructive fires around, because Australia was moving away from the Antarctica and closer to the equator. Nothing to do with climate change. And he actually said we're moving like this every whatever months, he thought it was. And he said, therefore, that's the reason for these terrible wildfires. And Australia just has to get used to them. And they have to learn how to deal with them. Because fire is not that bad. And there was a phrase that he said which stuck with us and particularly stuck with Dylan when he said this.
It's so much fresher now.
Yeah.
Fire is productive, not destructive.
Fire is destructive, not destructive. And so all through the rest of the holiday, we'd be going, fire is destructive. Fire is productive, not destructive. And he said, sorry, didn't do it much better than me, of course. But the fact is that actually is a lie. This story is that fire is both productive and destructive. We recognize fire as faith, as worship, as ritual, as belief. And it can bring benefit and it can bring harm. And perhaps you yourself personally, or you have witnessed at some stage in your Christian journey, the conviction of belief, the passion for truth, the zeal from the Bible, the boldness to witness as fire, energy, passion. And I'm not knocking that at all. Were Nadab and Abihu full of religious zeal that they were too immature to deal with? The sacred fire of their responsibility they had, they just couldn't handle and they didn't know the danger. They didn't understand how actually destructive it could be. You see, when the fire of our faith, of our ritual, of our worship, of our theology becomes destructive and not productive, we know it has become strange, unfit, unholy, unauthorized. And one of the books I've been reading, Leviticus You Have No Idea, by a guy called Morris D. Harris, he says this: as Nadab and Abihu rushed forward with their fire pans and lit fires, they thought they were holy, only to create great destruction. Fundamentalism invites a kind of pious zeal that can easily scorch everyone and everything in its path. You see, he touches on religious fundamentalism, but of course, faith and ritual and belief and worship can be political ideology, it could be religious or whatever, but it comes in a fiery form which is sacred and which needs to be guarded and protected and used with caution. And it's Karen Armstrong, a historian, says that sometimes our faith and our belief and our worship can come across as belligerent righteousness. What a great phrase. Belligerent, hostile, aggressive, but we're right with it. It's belligerent goodness, a belligerent holiness. And look, I've got a stake in the game here, but I'm going to say it anyway, because I was following what was going on when we were in Australia in the Anglican Church over the last couple of months. And I observed that the Anglican Church is a community at war. And there are some sections of the community church that seem to be lighting a fire of doctrinal zeal and purity against the blessing of same-sex marriages. And it is a fire which doesn't mind who it scorches, who it consumes, and who it burns. It is, in my book, a belligerent righteousness. Nadab and Abihu dishonored and disrespected fire, the sacred fire which they were to handle carefully. They usurped their role, their responsibility, they trespassed into boundaries they weren't supposed to go, and they lacked humility. The conviction of faith is good. Ritual and worship is good. It can be good and holy and honourable and beneficial and a blessing. But without humility, it is dangerous and destructive. So my final question to you is, how can we experience God's holy presence even spread the sacred fire of faith without consuming ourselves or others. Let's pray. Father, we know the Christian life is a journey of learning, sometimes a journey of failure. It's a journey of realizing that we don't have even some of the answers, let alone all of them. Help us to remain humble in our conviction. Help us to be working out what it means to love and to live wisely in the crucible of our lives, in the interaction with people that we struggle to love and to like, in encounters with people who are houses of sacred intelligence. So challenge this day as we go into this week. Help us to know that we don't need to perform. We don't need to be productive. We don't need to produce X, Y, or Z in order to get your love or your favor or your blessing or your attention. Because you are here and we have your attention. We have your blessing and we have your favor. Let that be an encouragement as we go into this week. In Jesus' name.